Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to the Gallipoli Club, where John Fraser makes a welcome first appearance as a speaker at the Sydney Institute, although he has been one of our members for some time. So it's great to have Mr. Fraser here in his capacity as Secretary to the Treasury. He'll be well known to many of you. I'll introduce him briefly. He was educated at Monash University, went into the Commonwealth Public Service, spent 20 years in Treasury, including two stints in Washington, D.C., one with the IMF and the second as Minister of Economics in the embassy, returned as Deputy Secretary to the Treasury at the time of the latest recession, or most recent recession, of some 25 years ago now, then to UBS, where he held a number of positions, ending up as head of the Global Management Fund in 2001, which was one part of UBS, which survived very well the global financial downturn of recent memory. He then went to another position, stepped down as CEO in 2013, whereupon I think he joined or rejoined the Sydney Institute and then got the call to become Treasury the Secretary, which he did, commencing in 2015. So Mr. Fraser's got a background in government, business and public service broadly defined. And the topic for tonight's talk is the Australian budget, some context. Mr. Fraser, very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Great to be here. Both of my time in Washington, D.C. and more recently in London, I think the role of institutes such as this one, this great one, is fantastic, and it's the more we can develop institutes to help general thinking, the better. What I want to do tonight is rather simple, outline some of the background to the current budgetary situation and some of the issues that confront the government. It's a dry subject, but an important one. As you all know, no budget ever satisfies everybody. The world and Australia are not short of people who have become budget experts. There will always be a wide range of views as to appropriate budget settings, and there are no shortage of people who feel that they have been harshly treated in any budget. And now and again, there are even some who are satisfied. Framing budgets is difficult and has always been so. The main difference now compared with my experience in the 1970s, 80s and the early 90s is that everything seems far more complex. There is always the challenge of the immediate budget year, but now increasingly we need to frame a budget over the 4 years of the forward estimates. If anything, the forward estimates now seem to be a little bit more important, and that is probably a good thing, as we are far more sensitive to consequences beyond the immediate year. But it can also foster a little complacency about the immediate challenge. Beyond the immediate budget year and the forward estimates, we must now be more mindful of the longer-term pressures on government spending from population trends, and in particular the ageing of the population, and the associated rapidly growing pressures on health funding. Now, over the years, forecasting the budget aggregates has become more difficult. I believe this is because of continued uncertainty surrounding the forecast, the economic forecasts that underpin the budget. We are now obviously a far more integrated part of the global economy and far more at the mercy of international financial and economic pressures. And I say financial because I don't think we've come to grips truly with the linkage between financial markets and the real economy.
That's very much. I need you to talk a bit more into the microphone.
Right, sorry. We're in business now?
It's a bit louder, yeah.
Is that better? Okay. All right. Unexpected movements in domestic and global factors that drive Australia's economy and the economic outlook include greater than anticipated movements in commodity prices, and a number of broader political factors. These have meant in every budget update since 2014, every one of them, the fiscal outlook has been downgraded. Each time we've had projections of larger deficits and higher debt levels. The mid-year economic and fiscal outlook, MIEFO released late last year, revised down the Treasury's estimates of Australia's current and future potential GDP. That revision also implied a greater share of the current and prospective budget shortfalls stem from structural rather than cyclical factors. The clear message was and is that we cannot rely on any cyclical bounce to reduce outlays as a percentage of GDP or, for that matter, the budget deficit. Now, let's be clear, we are not in a crisis, but the budget is rightly a focus of attention. That said, Australia has a strong fiscal position by international standards. Indeed, many countries would like to be in our position. But we have a structural budget problem that arose before the global financial crisis. The recent weakness in revenue is only partly to blame. From the outset of the commodity price boom of the early 2000s, government revenue grew faster than expected as the terms of trade persistently exceeded expectations. But, and this is a big but, structural expenditure decisions offset much of that temporary revenue gain. In particular, a very substantial amount of that revenue gain was spent on ongoing programs that increased transfer payments and benefits. In simple terms, and as I said in my speech to CEDA in February last year, some of the proceeds of our once-in-a-generation commodity price boom were used to pay down debt and set against future liabilities through the creation of the Future Fund. And there were also changes to the personal income tax scales over this period that also helped to relieve pressure on households and reward personal effort and initiative. In addition, the work of fiscal repair during the late 1990s and early to mid-2000s provided an important buffer for when the global economy was hit by the GFC. But, and this is a big but too, but a very substantial amount of the revenue windfall was used to lock in long-term spending commitments. And since then, the rate of government spending growth has remained high despite considerable savings measures over more recent years. Now, at first, this could be attributed to global financial crisis-related fiscal stimulus, but as temporary measures, stimulus measures, were unwound, growth in spending continued apace. This in part reflected a number of ongoing welfare and other spending programs that were put in place in response to the GFC, but largely became a permanent feature. In real terms, spending has grown at an annual average rate of around 3.5% since 2007, compared with around 3% during the 1980s and 90s. As a result, at 25.9% of gross domestic spending product, spending in 2015 and 16 is forecast to be close to the post-GFC peak, and indeed could have been higher were it not for the measures taken by the government in December's MIEFA. More recent savings measures are helping. The payments to GDP ratio will now decline over the budget forward estimates to 25.3% by 2018-19. But spending will not get below 25% at any time we expect over the next decade. Now, that's on current projections. They can change. But that's a very telling statistic. Some of the key drivers of this change have been in critical programs like aged care, disability care, and help for the unemployed and sick. Commonwealth interest payments have also risen sharply, contributing to the overall rise in the payments to GDP ratio, and this is despite a period of remarkably low borrowing costs. In recent years, falling commodity prices combined with more moderate wage and price growth domestically have seen Australia's nominal GDP growing at 50-year lows. And while real GDP growth rates have remained respectable in the face of difficult global circumstances, the fact is it's nominal GDP that matters for revenue. Indeed, Much of the deterioration in the budget position has been the result of revenue collections falling short of forecast, as we experience the flip side of the mining investment boom. Now, Treasury's recent reassessment of the assumptions behind our medium-term growth projections resulted in the estimated potential output growth rate being lowered from 3% to 2.75%. These changes are crucial for the real GDP outlook for the final 2 years of the forward estimates. Forward estimates are over the next 4 years. That is, the final 2 years, 2017-18 and 18-19. And the growth projections, and their projections, not forecasts, have now been revised down in real terms from 3.5% to 3%. The nominal GDP and therefore the revenue projections for these years are now lower and, I believe, far more realistic. Now, there are no right answers when it comes to producing growth projections, as these figures are sensitive to the assumptions that underpin them. For those lower projections in the third and fourth year in the forward estimates, we use the same projection framework which is considered best practice internationally. Similar approaches are also used by the Congressional Budget Office in the States and the UK Office for Budget Responsibility. We haven't changed the way we forecast the first 2 years of the forward estimates, which uses a more granular approach to forecast, taking account of particular sectoral trends in areas like the housing market and exports. While this sectoral approach is very useful for forecasting the economy over the near term, it is not so useful over the longer horizons when aggregate factors on the supply side tend to play a larger role in shaping economic growth. Now, our approach to international forecasts is comparable to other organisations and also utilises intelligence from Australia's or from Treasury's international posts. The historically low nominal growth outcomes and lower growth projections alongside historically high payments to GDP mean that it's taking longer for the budget position to return to pre-crisis levels compared with the cyclical downturns of the early 80s and the 90s. Now, this brings me to observations on our current fiscal position. The government's medium-term fiscal strategy includes achieving budget surpluses on average over the course of the economic cycle. This will take time. That's not news. It will take time. Expenditure restraint will allow resources that would otherwise go to interest payments to be allocated to other priorities like reforms to the tax system and Commonwealth-state financial relations. Further, in the longer term, the Commonwealth achieving surpluses means that the states can run small overall deficits that they can use to finance productive infrastructure investment. This model was a key conclusion of the 1993 National Savings Report commissioned by the then Treasurer, John Dawkins. And in my view, this is still a very sound framework for thinking about fiscal policy now. Now, the rising structural deficits and debt give rise to very clear intergenerational issues. Why should the living standards of future generations be compromised just because we are not willing to make sacrifices to address unsustainable growth of government expenditure? In December, the MIEFO showed that the budget is projected to return, and I say projected, is to return to a small surplus in the early 2020s. These surpluses are projected to peak at only 0.4% of GDP and then indeed decline over the medium term. Now, budget repair has proved difficult in recent years for a range of reasons. This can be demonstrated by looking at how our estimates for the 2016-17 year, the year coming up, have evolved over time. At the 2013, and I apologise for all these dates, at the 2013 pre-election Economic and Fiscal Outlook, PEFO, which was brought down in August 2013, we expected there to be a surplus of 0.2% of GDP in the 2016-17 year. Since then, the expected underlying cash balance has deteriorated by some $37.9 billion, with the most recent estimate being a deficit of 2.0% of GDP for 2016-17. Of course, excessive downgrades to tax receipts have been the main driver of this deterioration. In total, we now expect to receive around $39 billion less in tax receipts in 2016-17 than we did at the time of the framing of the 2013 PIFA, a massive change. Income tax receipts are being weighed down by lower than expected working age population growth and weaker wages growth, as well as declines in commodity prices and indeed weaker equity markets. The impacts of successive revenue downgrades have only been partially offset by government structural savings measures. Around $14 billion of these measures are yet to pass the Senate, and further delays will have a negative impact on the fiscal outlook. At the same time, some of the measures that successfully passed were amended in Senate negotiations. Importantly, further savings of around $8 billion were announced at December's MAIFA. Now, the Commonwealth's gross debt is projected to reach 29% of GDP by June 2018. Now, even during the volatile 1980s and 1990s, debt did not reach such heights. At that time, it peaked at around 24%, compared with that 29% expected number in June 18. Net debt is now approaching levels not seen since the early 1990s recession, which at the time was the highest since World War II. And we are yet to return to pre-GFC net debt levels. Now, around two-thirds of Commonwealth public debt is held by non-resident investors, and this share has risen since 2009 and remains historically high. If anything, this leaves Australia's fiscal position a little more exposed to shocks in global capital markets. The Commonwealth's interest bill has reached over $1 billion a month. This is projected to more than double within the decade, unless action is taken to improve our budget situation. Importantly, although debt serving costs as a proportion of GDP are around half what they were in the mid-1990s, government debt is currently being serviced at historically low interest rates. Thank God. At my EFO in December, borrowing costs were estimated at just under, and this is borrowing costs across the whole gamut of our debt, at just under 3% compared to the cost of around 8.5% 20 years ago. The debt burden and servicing costs are growing with each budget deficit and will grow even faster when, as we all expect, global bond yields inevitably normalise. If the bond rate were returned to its long-term average of about 7.25%, the government's debt servicing costs would increase by over $29 billion over the four-year forward estimates period. Now, it's important, I know it's self-evident, but it's important that Australia maintains its top credit ratings, which helps to contain the costs associated with servicing public debt. Australia is one of only 10 countries with a AAA credit rating from all three of the major credit rating agencies, reflecting our reputation, a well-deserved one, for fiscal prudence. But this rating is dependent on credible fiscal consolidation and a smooth transition to a more diverse economy. We should not be complacent about this. I know from personal experience during the financial crisis in 2008 how important a strong credit rating is to investor confidence, not only for governments but also, of course, for private institutions. Now, if we are to permanently reduce net debt, we're going to need to achieve sustained structural policy improvements. It can be difficult to separate accurately which elements of the budget should be considered structural and which cyclical. And there are many measures that attempt to do so, but all have their limitations. Treasury assesses the long-term position of the budget by estimating the so-called structural budget balance. But in essence, the structural budget balance is an estimate of what the budget position would be in the absence of cyclical or temporary factors. For example, cyclically high unemployment rates raise government expenditure via higher unemployment benefits and lowers government revenue via lower labour income tax receipts. With the exception of unemployment benefits, government expenditure is assumed to be structural. MyEFO showed a structural budget deficit of around 1.75% of GDP in 2015-16, compared with an underlying cash deficit of around 2.25% of GDP. So based on these estimates, only around 10 billion of the 37.4 billion deficit is considered to be due to the weak cyclical state of the economy. Treasury's estimates of the structural budget deficit have successively worsened over the past several years in line with downgrades to the underlying cash balance. Our immediate priority is to repair the fiscal situation, both structural and otherwise. Now, sadly, there are no hard and fast rules on fiscal repair. There are many factors to consider. There were determined efforts to cut spending in the 80s and also in the late 90s. They were characterised by limiting new spending and or fully offsetting net new policy with savings from the same portfolios through better targeting of transfer payments and also changes to payments to the states. Going forward, the more we can do to limit net new policy, the better, and that includes reprioritisation of spending within portfolios. For the longer term, we need to look for substantial structural savings across the board, including transfer payments. The government has had some recent success in passing measures for expenditure restraint, which are expected to limit the growth of welfare payments over coming years. Generally speaking, our welfare spending is highly targeted and redistributive. After taking into account the low level of tax paid by those on lower incomes, Australia redistributes more to the poorest 20% of the population than any other OECD country except Denmark. And as a side note, the OECD recently reported that Australia spent well below the OECD average on pensions. But when other forms of assistance are included, such as non-cash benefits, for example, subsidised healthcare and superannuation tax concessions, Australia compares more than favourably. Australia's retirement income system also ranks favourably compared with other countries, taking into account the age pension, household savings and home ownership. The Melbourne Mercer Global Pension Index ranked Australia third out of 25 countries overall and first for adequacy. At MyEFO, total Commonwealth payments as a proportion of economic output were estimated at 25.9% in 2015-16, the year just passed. There have been only four other periods since 1970 when this ratio has exceeded 25%. Three of those are associated with economic recession and deficit blowouts during the early 80s and the 90s, and of course just after the GFC. Part of the increase in the ratio has, of course, been the result of weaker than expected nominal GDP growth, meaning that even if government payments remained at their nominal level, the ratio would tend to increase. But there has also been a number of policy decisions over recent years that have pushed the ratio higher, including increasing base pensions and supplementary payments, increased defence operations and border protection spending, expenditure related to the carbon compensation package, and the outcomes of negotiations around the repeal of the mineral resources rent tax. And the government continues to face spending pressures. Within the current budget estimates, there are a number of programs whose spending is expected to ramp up in coming years, including spending associated with the NDIS. If payments stay too high, and at 25% of GDP or more, receipts will need to be increased very substantially to balance the budget. Simply increasing the overall tax burden to raise more revenue is, I believe, not the answer. It runs the real risk of distorting economic incentives and lowering international competitiveness with negative impacts on investment growth and job creation. Of course, it's always a matter of judgment, but seeking to keep spending below 25% of GDP may be a useful marker. This would mean that we would seek to avoid having spending reach or exceed the levels met in periods of especially adverse circumstances in the past few decades. Now, the fact is there are seldom easy choices when expenditure savings are required. There are many worthwhile spending programs, and every year there are many good ideas. There are far more good ideas and government resources to support them. There is often a mismatch between what the community expects the government to support and what they are prepared to pay for, either in tax or user charges. In framing budgets, we are really asking ourselves, now and in the longer term, what sort of society we want to have. As I've said many times before, as a wealthy country, we have a clear responsibility to support the most disadvantaged in our community. And we can only do that by having a strong and sustainable fiscal position. Laying out a path of sensible and credible fiscal repair, along with a plan for structural reforms that address our long-term growth challenges, will provide the building blocks for long-term fiscal sustainability and strong and stable economic growth. Faced with the same difficult choices that Australia now faces, many developed countries have managed to undertake significant budget repair in a relatively short time, while at the same time they have seen economic growth prosper. For example, the US budget deficit has been reduced by 9.3% of GDP since its peak in 2009 to a deficit of 3.8% of GDP, although I note that this has only been partly policy-driven. Blocks to spending proposals in Congress have also very much assisted. But the US economy has been growing since 2010, and GDP is now almost 10% higher than prior to the GFC. Now, where I've just come back from living for 13 years, the UK has reduced their budget deficit by 6% of GDP since the peak in 2009. The UK economy has been growing since 2010, and GDP is now around 6% higher than prior to the GFC. Ireland managed to record the greatest improvement, admittedly a small country, the greatest improvement, reducing their deficit from 32% of GDP to 2% over 5 years. Ireland's GDP growth was 6.8% through the year to September and has been growing strongly since the middle of 2013. Ireland's GDP is now more than 7% higher than prior to the GFC. Now, Australia's budget position never was as bad as these countries, and our economy never stopped growing, but we cannot be complacent. Expenditure restraint played a key role in all these countries in improving their fiscal situation. All that said, over the longer term, economic growth will be critical for fiscal sustainability, as well as continued improvements in living standards and our ability to support the weak and disadvantaged in the community. This will require ongoing productivity-enhancing structural reform. The 2015 Intergenerational Report highlighted the long-term challenges that lie ahead. The ageing of Australia's population will weigh heavily on Australia's potential growth rate and long-term fiscal position. Demographic and broader medium-term pressures will place greater demands on government finances, making deficit and debt reduction more difficult. Structural reform is critical, and this includes reforming competition policy and, I believe, implementing the Harper Review recommendations. Improving productivity is a far more sustainable way to boost economic growth than, for instance, relying unduly on exchange rate depreciation. These growth-enhancing policies also very much include tax reform. Tax is not just about raising revenue. It's also about helping to shape the economy so that we can attract and deploy resources in a manner to promote long-term growth. The arguments for a tax mix switch rest heavily on encouraging more jobs through a higher growth path. Tax reform is a complex issue and is very much, as you know, the focus of the government at the current time. So, to conclude, we are a very rich country in so many, many ways, both economically and culturally and also politically. And we can look forward to sustained economic growth, but we need to have the right attitudes and the policies. And I would suggest a stronger long-term fiscal position will go hand in hand with other policies to lift our growth and living standards. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Many thanks, Mr. Fraser, for an important address. So we'll go to questions and discussion. We'll finish no later than 7 o'clock, perhaps a bit before. I remind you not to stand in front of the camera. And I'll ask our speaker just to speak straight into the microphone. Thanks for that analysis. You spoke at the end about attitudes, but you had a lot of very important hard economic statistics, particularly about debt, in your paper. If you, as you would be aware these days, if you turn on an ABC radio program, you'll hear constant groups in the community asking for more money for this project or that project, or that government should do more here or there. So as you would be aware, in the 1990s, when we had a real recession, the mood in the electorate seemed to be different. I mean, people stepped back a bit from the demands on government, but perhaps it's because of 25 years of no recession that attitudes don't seem to reflect the reality. I mean, what can anyone explain the reality in a way that will be understood, or do you need another recession to bring some feeling of reality about ever-increasing expenditure?
I would hate to think we needed a crisis to address these issues. It's ever been thus that people want things from government, whether it's in Australia or overseas. It certainly was the case in the when I was living in the States in the late 70s, that was going through a pretty decent recession. Jimmy Carter lamented on a Sunday night address that people felt the government owed them more than he thought they could get. I think it's just a fact of life. I think the recession we had in the early 90s was a pretty decent recession. We had unemployment above 10%. I was the Deputy Secretary Economic at Treasury at the time, and it was a very lonely time. And fortunately, I think with economic policies, the then government stuck with it, and they stuck with some very good reforms. And they also stuck with a policy of fiscal repair. I think we're growing well at the moment. I think we're swimming against an international tide very well. 2.75% real growth is good. So I'm not saying in any sense we have a crisis. It's about addressing issues now rather than waiting for them perhaps to worsen a little. I think also there's a lot more realistic debate. When I arrived back just over a year ago, I was struck by what I thought was a pretty tough debate, but I think the debate in the press and elsewhere has got better, and there's a lot more sensible debate around the tax reform and indeed around spending programs. You just had to look at the papers over the past few weeks in terms of some of the welfare areas, and nobody, certainly I don't, denies that we must look after the weakest people in the community. That's our obligation. But I'm encouraged that the attitudes are not too bad in this country. They're certainly better than in a lot of the European countries, certainly the continental European countries.
Thanks. I just remind, we take questions from our membership base here, and media can talk to Mr. Fraser after if he has time. There's a question here.
Mr. Fraser, you spoke of the importance of productivity to grow the economy, yet at all levels of government there are increasingly anti-productivity measures being deployed, whether labour productivity, land use productivity, capital use, regulation, financial services. How can we how can the government on one hand talk about productivity, the importance of productivity, yet on the other hand put barriers to productivity all over the economy?
Well, I think a lot of people would dispute that we're moving to a worse position. I think the reports that I've mentioned, the Harper report in particular, has a very keen thrust about getting competition and better service delivery at both the state and the Commonwealth levels. I think the work done by Peter Harris at the Productivity Commission has been pointing in that direction. But it's hard. It's hard. It's the productivity gains we got in the 90s were terrific, and they came through some pretty path-breaking productivity reforms coming out of the Hilmer report. They were big ones, and we're now perhaps into another round where I think, frankly, it's a bit harder, it's a bit more amorphous, But what has been terrific has been the discussions at the Commonwealth, the CIFA meeting, CFFR, with the Treasurer and his counterparts at the state and territory levels, is there's a real recognition between the Commonwealth and the states that we can all do better, whether it be in delivery of hospital services, health more generally, or education, roads, roads usage, and infrastructure. So I think we're moving in the right direction. There might be questions about the pace of it, but I think we're moving in the right direction. The Harper report's a good report, a very good report.
There's a question down there. Got to keep your questions brief.
Yeah. My name is Leonard Young. Do you think the government should increase the GST to 15%?
There's a question on the GST, but that's more a policy question, I think, not something for the Treasury Secretary to handle.
My colleague answered that brilliantly.
Yeah. I've worked in the public service. Yeah. I guess question there.
Mr. Fraser, there's a lot of respectable commentary suggesting that international factors could well lead this year or soon to a crisis similar to that of 2008. If that were to happen, in what sort of shape is the Australian economy now to face a crisis like that of 2008?
If we were to go back to a crisis like 2008, is the Australian economy in good shape to handle that?
I think we're in very good shape. I think we were in good shape in 2008, and a lot of that came, I think, from measures that were taken in the early 1990s and getting our financial sector in much better shape. People forget things were a bit rough in the early 1990s. A number of the state banks were closed. There was a lot of rationalisation. I think the Australian financial sector, as the Canadians who went through a similar process, we benefited from that in 2008. Since then, I think we're even stronger. We've seen what Wayne Byers has done through APRA in terms of capital ratios. We've seen the banks recognise the importance of proper and prudential management. So I think we're in very good shape. And I think that shows up in how the rating agencies regard us.
Thank you.
Right, so there's a question there. Yes?
You referred in passing to the great increases in expenditure on border protection. Going back to what the UK has managed to do, it's notable that they retain their international development assistance at the same levels and they're continuing on that trajectory. It's not something Australia's chosen to do. Do you foresee that we might be able to reverse the balance and spend less on border protection and more on helping our neighbours live fuller lives through meeting the commitment we made at the beginning of the century?
Well, again, I think a question on border protection is a bit hard for the Treasury Secretary to answer, but you can have a go if you want to.
Well, maybe you could just comment on the fact that the UK kept their development assistance up throughout this whole challenging period.
I note it, but as Gerard said again, it's a political issue. It's a matter about choices.
Okay, so there's a question here. We've got to be brief, okay? Yeah.
Okay. Right. You've mentioned about the increasing welfare spending and also the tax reform. Do you think that people are demanding welfare because the government's taxing them too much, they don't have enough to look after themselves?
Do you think that people are demanding more? What's that? Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, I understand the question. No, I...
Well, just repeat the question, okay?
Well, as I'm understanding, you're saying the increased welfare spending is partly a response, or the demand for it, is because people feel they're taxed too much and they don't have the wherewithal to look after themselves. Look, I think we have a very good welfare system. It can always be improved. It is well targeted. It probably can be better targeted going forward. But, you know, we've got to be... we are what we are. We're a country that looks after our people. So I don't see that link. I don't see that link. A big driver is the ageing of the population. We can't get away from that. And the big driver is not going to affect just welfare spending. It's going to affect health spending. And I often think maybe that's forgotten a little bit in the debate. We talk about saving for retirement, but sadly I and others have probably seen the demise of parents and how much money is spent as people get older and they approach their passing. So I think it's just a function of population and population trends. And sadly, as I'm reminded every time I look in the mirror in the morning, the ageing of the population.
Question here.
Question, can this system be stable when half the taxpayers receive as much or less, more from the government than they give, and addition to those 12 million taxpayers, there are plenty of other voters that are not taxpayers. So inherently, there's a bias towards wanting the government to spend more.
Look, I think there's a bias around the world that individuals will generally want more. It's just a fact of life. It's, if you can get something more, that's your demand. But people are pretty sensible. I mean, the great thing about Western democracies is they generally get it right. It might take time. And I think there's, in this country, we've got people who have been increasingly sensible about realising that governments can't provide everything. But equally, and I don't step away from it, governments need to look after the weakest in the community. If we don't do that, then as a society, it's pretty sad.
Question on the back, yes.
The UK Office of Budget Responsibility now takes into account secondary impacts of policy changes when they're doing their forecasts. And I've always felt, having worked at Treasury forecasting and then worked in the private sector, that Treasury didn't really harness its forecasting capacity by forecasting the implications of those policy, some of the policies that are being considered. Has there been more work done within Treasury to bring those two areas together, policy and forecasting, so the numbers guys look at the policy right?
I was talking with a very esteemed senior colleague flying back from Canberra today, and we both said the bane of our existence is having to produce forecasts. It struck me that coming back into Treasury after 22 years away, forecasting hasn't progressed that much. We're still seeing models that really were developed principally in the 70s and the early 80s. I think it's, and I can give a, Warren Tease, who's joined us recently from the private sector, has produced a very good analysis of our, or appraisal of our forecasting process, which he will be publishing. And, you know, there's shortcomings. The point you mentioned about the second round, I think we do try to get them, and the models can capture them. The biggest issue, I find, is the growth of the financial sector so massively in the last 20 years and trying to get that marriage between financial developments through wealth and other matters on the real aggregates. The best forecast I've had was when I was running UBS Global Asset Management. We had a woman who ran my hedge funds for me, and she was brilliant. And she did it in a very non-model way. She would literally get as wide a circle of people, informed people together, get them to think about it, then come back a week later, and it was a very iterative process. And she was trying to make money out of it. She made a lot of money out of it. I don't know the answer. I really don't. All I know is we keep trying. What we have tried to do more in Treasury over the years is have a lot more interaction with the private sector. I've established an office in Sydney, down here on Market Street, that's up and running. There'll be one opened in Melbourne shortly. The Sydney office is fast approaching 40 people. And that's an opportunity for us not only to liaise with the big end of town, but with everybody. And that has helped us greatly already in our forecasting. But, you know, the rule with forecasting is if you can avoid making a forecast, avoid it.
And the Melbourne office will be at the same level of Sydney or around that?
The Melbourne office at the moment, we're thinking around about 25 to 30 people. Sydney's going to be about 40. The great thing about the two offices also is that we've got a lot of people coming in from the big accounting firms, some of the legal firms, who are coming in for two, even shorter years, maybe some 3 years. They don't have to move to Canberra, and that's a big attraction for people who've got families or spouses, partners who are working. And I've been delighted with the support from a number of the firms having people come in for that 2 to 3 years. It's helped us greatly in our understanding of the financial sector. It's helped us greatly on taxation matters and also in foreign investment, but generally on getting a bit of a feel for the economy. So I'm delighted with that.
There's a question down there, yeah. Just speak up.
Sorry,
we can't hear you.
Leaders in New South Wales and elsewhere around the country for increased taxation to pay for things like health due to the aging population. was wondering if you can comment, if you can, on how much scope there is for reversing returns, including for productivity improvements for healthcare, so that we can make it more sustainable.
There's a suggestion that political leaders are calling, in the States, are calling for greater taxation in order to handle matters like healthcare, and the suggestion is, should we be instead focusing on increasing productivity in health, state health departments rather than calling for taxation to increase revenue in the area?
That's my ship. I've got to go. I think there's been terrific advances in healthcare. I've had occasion to go to a couple of rather large hospitals in Melbourne and talking to the triage nurse who ran the whole place. It was fascinating talking to her about the productivity improvements, the prioritisation of patients. And I think certainly from contact with my state and territory colleagues, there's a real recognition that there's even more work to be done, certainly also with education as well. The fact of the matter is we all want to live longer. We want to have a better quality of life. Medical technology is growing apace. And the expectations are very high. So it's going to cost more, and we're probably going to have to save more individually to meet that over the longer term. But I don't get a sense that the states are dropping the ball on this one. Quite the opposite. I think the states are being very sensible about looking at their available resources and what they can provide. But productivity is the answer. Productivity, you come back to it in all areas of life, private sector, and also with government. If you get productivity up, everybody's a winner.
So we go 1, 2, 3, end up with Milton, yes?
You mentioned the English and Irish experience where governments cut expenditure, cut the deficit, and at the same time the economy grew quite strongly. That seems to contrast with, say, the Japanese experience where the government has continued to apply stimulus to very little, if any, effect. Can you have a look at that and draw any conclusions for Australia from about the efficacy of Keynesian economics?
Well, I arrived in the States for the second time in September 1985, and the cover of Newsweek and the cover of Time were very similar, and they both said, how long will it take for the Japanese to take over the US economy? And that was like the kiss of death. It's been downhill ever since. I don't pretend to understand the Japanese economy. I don't pretend to understand how it functions. We all thought their productivity was fantastic. That turned out to be not the case. Innovation, we thought they were right ahead of it. That was not the... I had three firms running up in Tokyo, and lovely, lovely people. Worked hard for long hours. But I find it very hard to draw any conclusion out of it. It's very sad, and they've got the double whammy too, with a shrinking population. It's not just an aging population, it's a shrinking population, and that's not good, and they're very aware of it. But I don't pretend to be able to discern any lessons for us, I'm afraid. I'm not ducking the question. I really don't know the answer.
Next question. Yes.
You commented a number of times about the Harper Competition report, which you commented was reported, noting that government has responded to that at the end of last year. Hoping you could talk a bit about the priorities in terms of implementation or the approach to implementation of the recommendations, and also that key point between areas of state responsibility that have been acknowledged in that report.
Consequence of the implementation of the Harper report at the federal level and the state
level. Well, the great thing about Harper, and Ian's a great guy. I made the mistake of calling him a rock star at a speech in Melbourne in November, and I think he was terribly flattered about it. It's Harper is a Commonwealth state journey, and what's happened, I think, particularly in the last few months, is that it's been embraced by the states and the territories. It's certainly been embraced by the Commonwealth. The priorities are pretty clear. It's what I talked about, health and education service delivery. Overlaying that, and I think that's what you're getting at, there's the issues which are being discussed at COAG, and I think I know what the acronym, but you know what COAG is. I've only been back a year, I'm still learning. But there are issues about responsibilities as well. And it's clear that in some areas the Commonwealth may need to consider facilitating some of the reforms, because it will be money well spent if we get economic growth out of it. But I could not stand here and say that any of the states or territories are being recalcitrant about embracing the reform. And that's quite a contrast to 30 years ago. Quite a contrast.
Milton.
It was reported in the Financial Review this morning that the Treasurer suggested we might not see a green paper in relation to tax reform. I don't expect you to comment on his comments, but is Treasury still working on a tax paper, and do you expect to see
The question is Treasury still working on a tax paper?
That's not bad. That's a pretty good one. It's that's the ultimate curveball. I won't comment.
Right, so we're getting very close to the end. So, there's a question here. Yeah.
There's been a shift in regulatory authority or responsibility from the state to the Commonwealth in recent years. So what role in terms of facilitating productivity, facilitating competition between firms in the marketplace, can Treasury hold, particularly for those areas and agencies for which it holds responsibility, cast an economic, economic rule through the regulatory proposals that are coming up in regulation, especially prescriptive regulation as opposed to more broader performance-based regulation, to ensure that regulation doesn't restrict innovation, competition?
We're very much involved. We're very much involved through the ACCC, if we get an opportunity to comment on a lot of what they're doing with ASIC. I'll say again, because I believe in it, the Commonwealth-State relationships through CIFA, Commonwealth-Federal Financial Relations, I've got that one right, and also through the Head of Treasury's group that I chair. The meetings are very productive. They don't just range over fiscal matters. They get right into this nitty-gritty. We have a Council of Financial Regulators that Glenn Stevens chairs, and APRA and ASIC and Treasury on. We're very much involved. We only have, and I'm not seeking more staff, but we only have just under 800 people in Treasury, and we cover the whole waterfront. And my people in Treasury are wonderful, simply wonderful. But we're involved in everything. But what's more important is the state treasuries are getting involved in everything. And that's showing. That's showing in the results we're getting. And it's showing in the calibre of the debate. So I think we're getting there. There's a broader question about Commonwealth state responsibilities in this area. And a lot of the regulation is recognised, say, with land release and infrastructure. The hold-ups can be at the state or the local government level. And there's stuff also at the Commonwealth level. But I don't want to paint too rosy a picture, but I think the cooperation between the Commonwealth and the states is far better than I remember from 30 years ago. It's far more complex, but people are going into it with good hearts, and that's the most important thing.
Just a final... Oh, there's a question. Don't stand in front here. Quickly, yeah.
Mr. Fraser, you mentioned you've got 800 people in Treasury.
Yes.
I believe the RBA's got 950. Why is that?
I think they've actually got more than 950. X the note printing agency, but I'll leave you to ask Glenn that. We are what we are. I understand we peaked at about 1,100 some years ago. As I said, I'm not seeking more staff. I'm just delighted with the quality of staff we've got. I am, and this is where I put the advertisement out, I took a personal interest in the graduate recruitment. We're taking in 41 graduates this year, and we're encouraging people to join us, not on the basis that I did in 73, that you're going to be carried out in a box, but if you want to come and join us for 2 to 3 years, see what it's like. If you want to then go on and do something else, work towards that being a good thing on your CV, and so that employers recognise that it's a good thing. My chief criterion for people joining us is enthusiasm, a desire to work in public policy. And I came back and I don't regret it. I mean, the thanks last about 2 weeks, but Public policy and public service is a very, very important part of life, and the great thing, I say that to a man and woman, everybody in Treasury, I think, is putting their shoulder to the wheel. But we are trying to get some people more who see us as part of their career than just something. As I said, they're going to be 40-year veterans. I love the 40-year veterans. I'm not saying I don't like them, but I just think we've got to have some younger people too.
Look, that's, there are other questions around, but that's a nice spot to end on. So I think we'll conclude there. Thanks. I remember the former Prime Minister saying that how appreciative he was that someone like Mr. Fraser would give up the career he was capable of taking once he returned to Australia and go in and do service in the Commonwealth government in a very senior role in, or the senior role in Treasury, and one of the most senior roles in the Commonwealth of Australia. And we've seen tonight Mr. Fraser's great sense of enthusiasm, the reforms that have come about, and particularly this new situation with so many young, new people and young people are moving in and out of Treasury and getting an enormous experience on the way, because there's nothing quite like an experience in the Commonwealth Public Service to teach anyone how government actually works. So what we've had tonight is some very interesting reflections on Treasury, on what you're doing and what your staff are doing, as well as a very important analysis about the Australian fiscal position right now and into the future over the forward estimates and beyond. So I'm sure there'll be a lot of interest in the Treasury Secretary's paper when it's published, as there was a lot of interest tonight in what you said. So we'd love to have you back sometime. It's great you've been one of our members for some years, and we'd love to have you back sometime. But for tonight, thank you and well done.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.